Okay. So didn't quite get through the exams. We'll talk about them on Tuesday. But the solution has been posted, so sorry about that. Today we're gonna kind of wrap up talking about input shaping. You get to see the system we're gonna control with this. That we have that lab coming, and then we'll talk about a piece that will show up again if you're gonna take vibrations. There's a kind of whole segment of this system in vibrations, but we'll touch on it briefly here because it shows up. It's important in control systems as well. So let's talk about some input shaping. I think most of you have probably seen this video. Just kind of give you an example of this input shaping stuff in action. So here we have a 10-ton bridge crane. It's actually at Georgia Tech. It's about 4 meters of cable up to the bridge trolley. It's a Cartesian axis, so XY. And then this is a pretty standard crane move. So we're trying to pick up this payload, which is, we can add counterweights and all kinds of stuff. Just kind of playing payload right now. Pick it up, move it over, and then into the board and set it down. So kind of a normal, if you will, crane move. Pick something up, take it somewhere else, set it down. So without input shaping, right, we're going to move this thing. And you'll be able to see it gets quite a large amount of vibration just right away. For even this kind of simple crane move. We are playing this back, or I'm playing this back at 2x speed because the natural frequency is so low. Right. So the max velocity of this crane is like 0.35 meters a second or something like that. But even this kind of low max velocity, low acceleration move for this kind of crane, you can get quite a lot of vibration. So right now, kind of the state of the art in crane control, where's my mouse at? Stop it. Anyway, here's the shape case. 30 seconds later, same crane. And what we've done here is something we're going to talk about a little bit in 15 slides or so, is actually being able to input shape for two different modes of oscillation. Because that particular payload has not just one mode. If you watch it, there's actually two frequencies here. So you have the normal pendulum one, and then you have kind of this string type vibration that shows up. And what's kind of interesting about that second mode of oscillation is that even really expert crane operators have a hard time controlling that second mode, right? They do a really good job if it acts just like a simple pendulum, right? I've driven enough cranes where I can kind of take care of a natural single pendulum type payload. But once that second mode shows up, you're done as a human operator. So state of the art in the field right now for moves like this is you would move even more slowly than we're moving here. We're actually, it's not such a slow move. But you move really, really slow, and then you'd have four or five of your coworkers come hold on to that thing while you're moving it. Right. Which is obviously not a very efficient way. Efficient use of manpower or safety. Yeah, that's the other big aspect, right? So you'll see there's a lot of crane accidents where operator kind of messes up and that thing starts swinging. If it's a 10-ton payload, four or five of your buddies are not stopping that thing. Right, so people will get pinned up against walls and beams and stuff like that. So it's actually a really dangerous operation in a lot of places. And then, depending on what you're moving, like we did a lot of work at Boeing, they're moving a piece of landing gear that's $10 million worth of investment by the time it's assembled. So you do final assembly, and then they run into stuff and breaks, and that's $10 million out the door. Right. So that's another big aspect for this vibration reduction is not just being able to move faster, in terms of control systems, and if we can control vibration, we can move faster, but a lot of companies are just interested in reduce the vibration because it's safer. Right? And Boeing was really, Boeing's primary interest in our work was from that perspective. This thing, if it starts swinging at all, that's a big problem. And that's where the input shaping stuff, where we said, hey, the maximum amount of vibration I can get is what I would have gotten without input shaping. That's not true for feedback controllers, as we saw. Right? You can design a feedback controller and it goes unstable, you're going to have enough vibration eventually that it just breaks. So there's some safety aspect that this input shaping control is able to provide that a feedback controller can't necessarily provide guarantees on. Okay, so here's a system. so this is the one you guys will be doing this lab on. So in this case, it's a kind of lab scale CDPM or CSPM. CDPM stands for cable driven parallel manipulator, CSPM cable suspended parallel manipulator. And basically, what you can imagine for this system is like the SkyCam at football games. All right, so you have cables that are driving the end effector around the workspace. And by controlling the length of those, in the SkyCam's case, those four cables, I can move that camera around the football field. And they use steel cables, I think. So even though steel cables, when they get to be hundreds of meters long, have enough stretch, right? And the nature of them just being strings will actually contribute to some vibration at the camera. So the SkyCam gets around that. They kind of balance the tension into the wires, but then they also have a lot of stabilization built into their camera system. And then, of course, if a camera taking pictures of football starts bouncing around too much, you just cut to a different camera. Whereas what we're trying to do is do something more than take pictures of football. Right, so imagine a SkyCam hung underneath a bridge, for example. And now we're taking pictures of the bottom of the bridge, stitching those together to do inspection. Right. And what we're looking for in that inspection is cracks and defects that are millimeter and smaller. So if you have the system, any kind of vibration at all, even stabilized camera views, really degrade your ability to pick out really small scale defects. So we need to have really, really high precision control of our kind of end effector out in the middle. Anybody know how we inspect bridges right now? Yeah, we just hang people underneath, basically. So it's another case where it's kind of a dangerous job for people. Right? So it kind of fits into, you guys heard of the 3Ds of robotics? If it's dirty, dangerous, or dull, we want to have some robot or automation doing it. So that probably falls into two of those categories, being dangerous and dull, I would think, in terms of bridge inspection. The other one is maybe we have some money from Louisiana Board of Regents for this project, looking at inspecting large chemical storage tanks this way, which don't really get inspected right now, which is kind of scary if you think about it a little bit. Or you could do something similar with a large ship when it's in dry dock for maintenance, perhaps. Or a project we work on a little bit with the Japanese company we work with for inspection, maintenance, cleaning of skyscrapers. So you essentially hang a planar, like this exact kind of version of that system on the side of a skyscraper, and you could run the end effector around the building, doing inspection, cleaning windows, doing painting, that kind of thing. So anyway, here's our system. Our cables are kind of short, so we actually don't get as much vibration from the kind of cable motion itself. So what we've added, and you can see it swinging here in this frame of this video, what we do is simply add pendulums to the end effector to kind of approximate what the vibratory nature of the system would be. And really what we're looking at is, can we control these cables in a way so that we're able to move this thing around where we don't excite oscillation? All right, so this is just me driving around with a joystick. Kind of example moves around that workspace. Just plugged in with a normal kind of PlayStation type joystick. And you see these moves around the workspace. Kind of simple ones, we get quite a lot of oscillation of that pendulum mode. We also get some rocking of the plate there, even for that kind of simple square shape, right? So we're trying to do something more complex, that can be a problem. And then we apply this input shaping thing. In this case, it's a ZV shaper. And what we're shaping here is just the frequency, what we're shaping for is just the frequency of the pendulum. So you see, for all these moves, the pendulum, when we get to the end, has really low vibration, but we didn't do anything about the plate rocking. And that's because we haven't explicitly considered the plate rocking in our control design. Maybe we can watch that again to take a better look at that. This time when we get to the shaping, take a look at the plate rocking, but also take a look at the motion of that plate. You should be able to see that it's input shaped. It's not a smooth ramp up to velocity. There are all these kind of sections of velocity. So you see it kind of ramps up half speed and then takes off the rest of the speed. So that's the ZV shaper working. And you see we're getting rid of the pendulum oscillation, but we're not shaping it, we're not trying to shape the plate rocking at all in this video. No. So they're just going on the side of the building, and they're basically using mechanical kind of connection to the building quite often. Or the system set up where it's kind of swinging them into the building, kind of. So the pivot from the cable is inside of where the actual car is, so it wants to swing into the building. But you still got to hang people out there, which is not. So it's kind of my standard slide on input shaping, just to review. So in that case, we were actually issuing velocity commands. So far, we've only seen step inputs, right? So if we take this velocity command, we still can do that kind of input shaping with it. A huge number of, and probably could argue the majority of human control systems are actually velocity control. Right? So if you're inputting, controlling something with a joystick, you're telling it go some speed in some direction. Right? So you're prescribing a velocity. Right? If you're driving a crane around, you're going to have buttons to say forward, left, right, reverse, whatever, north, east, southwest. It's going to be velocity command in that direction. We tend not to give position control to things if we're actually in the loop controlling it. So it's important that we can do this. And the nice thing about input shaping is it works across domains. So you can input shape force commands, you can input shape position commands, you can input shape velocity, you can input shape jerk. Right? And the process is exactly the same and it works just as well. It's just a nice feature of the method. So in this case, we have a velocity command. So imagine that's someone pushes the crane button down for a second and a half or something like that. In this case, so I go full speed, now stop, is all that command is in the velocity domain. Right? And then we have some flexible system. And here it's just an arbitrary oscillatory system that starts oscillating as a result of that command. So if we take that and convolve it with, in this case, a ZV input shaper, what's the resulting command look like in this case? Or let's back up maybe. How do we get to the resulting command? So let's say each of these, so we have two impulses. They look to be the same amplitude. They have to sum to one, so they're 0.5, 0.5. Let's say. All right. So maybe we can sketch this out. I just wanted to talk through. Right. So if I have some original command, maybe I'll just do those in color so we can tell them apart when we sketch it. Okay, so what's our process? Okay, so I take my original unshaped reference command, convolve it with multiply by the first impulse amplitude, and I do that at zero offset from the original. Right. So in that case, we're going to start at zero still, and we're going to go to 0.5 because that's the amplitude of that guy. And let's just put a number. Fake our scaling. Okay, he was blue. Okay, so there's the contribution of the first impulse. Okay, how about the second part? So I do the same time and I go to the time delta out here. All right, and I multiply by the original command and do that at zero or t plus delta for all time. Okay, so that means over here, that command is going to finish at 1.5 plus delta. All right, it's the same length command, 1.5, but it's just offset by delta. Okay, now what? Add them together, right. So I take every time step along the way and add them together. That simple. That's the exact same procedure. It doesn't matter what this command is. I just do that exact procedure. It doesn't matter how many impulses I have. It's that procedure if I do this convolution for an input shape. Pretty easy process, super easy to implement on any kind of hardware. Super easy to reason about, I think. So we got that one right, hopefully. Yes. And if we design this the right way, we get no vibration. What do we need in order, what do we need to know about our system in order to design an input shaper? We need to know natural frequency.
We need to know the plant as accurately as possible, probably.
I'm going to say no, you don't have to, strictly speaking, know that. What do we need to know about the system?
Just the natural frequency, the damping ratio.
Natural frequencies and damping ratios. So we don't even need a full model of the system. Right? All we need to know is the natural frequency and damping ratio of the vibration we want to get rid of. Right? That's also a contrast to most feedback control methods. It's really hard to design a good feedback controller if you don't have some full model of the system. Right? So I need to know natural frequency, and there may be more than one. And there may be, I need the damping ratios. There may be more than one of those, one for each mode. So I need to know this about every mode of vibration I want to get rid of. I have to have these two pieces of information. And then what's the penalty for doing this input shaping thing? Yeah, the command is longer. All right, so notice here, our command was finished at 1.5. The shape command is not finished at 1.5 plus delta. So our command duration is always increased by the duration of the input shaper. Okay? And that's the penalty. Usually that doesn't matter, right? Because what we really care about in this case is the blue. Not the red, right? So the blue has a much faster settling time, much lower settling time with the shape case compared to the unshaped. And that's quite often what we care about. We want to get to where we want to go and be settled as quickly as possible. Doesn't necessarily matter that the command itself to get there took longer for a huge number of systems. So is some kind of penalty, perhaps, but quite often it doesn't matter so much. Okay, and we just talked through this, so we can skip this slide. Okay, we talked through this guy, person, just to kind of refresh our memory. So if I'm going to do this in real time, kind of talk through. So I take some value at my first time step, and I multiply by my first impulse and do that right now. I take my input at this time step, multiply by the second impulse, and save that for time t2. So as we talked about at the very end of class, on Tuesday. And I just repeat that throughout time. Right? And then when I get to, you know, times where I have both inputs between tau and delta and 1.5 over here, I just have to do the addition. So I take whatever I had saved and add the current value, current part to it, right, and issue that command to my system. Okay, so all this is doing is taking this, doing this process, slice by slice. Because quite often, we're not going to know this whole command ahead of time. Right? So we have to take a slice, do that part, take another slice of time, do that part as it comes into us, as we're getting that information from our user or some other algorithm. Okay. So I mentioned we can do that pretty easily, even really low-cost hardware. So that piece of hardware in the background probably looks familiar to you guys. Up here in the right of this plot, we'll zoom it up in a minute. But basically, you can see I'm just doing exactly what we did there, the button being a velocity command. So you'll see I'll push the button down. And I'm showing kind of both A1 and A2 components in blue and red, and then the total shape command as well is streaming. So pretty easy to do. Again, even super low cost hardware has no trouble doing this in real time. Pretty straightforward. Okay. There is a little bit of an issue with how we've been talking about it so far, right? What we went through here. Effectively, without thinking about this a little bit, we're going to need infinite amount of memory to be able to do this for all time, right? Well, we haven't said anything, you know, once I need to save some values for the future, but then once I get out here and use them, I don't want to really still be hanging on to these pieces of information. Right? So I need some buffer that saves them, but I have to have some way that buffer gets cleared out, or else I run out of memory eventually to store those values. It's going to take a long time, but you would. So what we actually do is actually use this concept called a ring buffer. You'll actually see this taught sometimes in a ring. That's why it's called a ring buffer. So basically, you'll have a set of memory like this. So, I mean, we got 11 bytes right now of memory. So in each of these bytes of memory, it's these chunks of memory, I can store a value. So then I'm going to have in this image, I'm going to have a current index. So I'm looping through this buffer. And my current time step, I keep track of where I'm at in this buffer. Right? And then I'm going to have some current index and always offset by the time of the shaper. Right? And it's the time of the shaper divided by the time each one of these steps represent. So it's really just like the implementation we just saw, where it's kind of time steps. Right? So in this case, I get some input in, right? Current index, I actually just do this right now, and I save part of it for later. Right? And this is just how far out in that array I have to go in order to save it for later. Right? That's all this offset here is. How many time steps over do I need to go? Yeah.
I might be wrong because I was going to ask you after class, but is that part of the digitize function in your shaping library? Or is that something
in the shaping library, what that will do is if... Right, these are discrete time steps,
yeah.
And depending on the width of those time steps, you might have an impulse that's supposed to be between them.
Yeah.
So it will split it between the two. This is not quite that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I have my current index. Okay, so I get a command in, I do part of it now, I save part of it for later. That's all this is showing so far. Okay. Next time in the step, I get a command in, I do that part now, save some part for later in my memory. Okay. Next time step, I do some part now, save the third time step for later. So far, no different than what we've talked through. Where it gets different is when I get out here to the end of the array. Right? I don't want to keep marching through my memory, because eventually I will run out. And particularly if you're going to do this on a cheap microcontroller, low-power microcontroller. So when I get to this place, I have some current index, and I'm showing it's purple because we have some blue there, and we'd already saved some red. So current index, now I have this addition that's happening there. And I'm running out the end of my array. So any guesses to what we do with the next time step? Yeah, you loop back around. Right. That's kind of why it's called a ring index. So you can draw it as a circle where it's connected. Right. So now the next stop, I had some red there, I have a blue, do this now, save the next one over here. Right. This is called a ring buffer. Right. So it's a way to loop through a fixed amount of memory forever, essentially. These get used all the time. So, and really all you need to keep track of for an input shaping ring buffer is your current index in the array. Because you know your later impulse is always going to be offset. So you need to know how much memory you have, and then each loop through your controller, you need to know what your current index is within the array. It's actually really easy to implement. But you can do that in a fixed amount of memory. It becomes important. So let's talk through the equations. This should hopefully look familiar. It's our vibration equation we talked through on Tuesday. And we form a constraint from this by setting that the vibration less than some tolerable value. Right? And we've talked through the ZV shaper, which sets VTOL to what?
Zero.
Right? We've talked through an EI shaper. What does the EI shaper do? Yeah, it relaxes it to some VTOL. Basically. And 5% is a typical value for an EI shaper. Okay. What other kind of constraints do we have on these input shapers? Some of the impulses needs to be one. Sure. What does that ensure for our shaped command?
Same time ending.
Same time ending.
No.
Yeah, kind of same set point. Same steady state is one way to think about it. Right. So yeah, ensures we reach the same kind of end desired state or end steady state up from the command. Okay. We've also talked about primarily so far these positive shapers. So if you have a positive shaper, the idea is to limit every impulse to be greater than zero. So these two constraints combined mean all your impulses have to be between zero and one. And then we've seen this a few times already. So positive shapers, this convolution process will create some commands like this. Okay. We also have, this is really the first kind of super new thing today, a class of input shapers called unity magnitude input shapers. And they're called unity magnitude because the magnitude of the impulse is always one. Right? The sign switches back and forth from one impulse to the next. Okay? So we still maintain that all the impulses have to sum to one. That constraint still holds. We still have the same vibration constraint. All we've done is get rid of all these things have to be positive and say, hey, well, we want them to switch between plus and minus one now. So that means by necessity we are going to have an odd number of impulses always. And how many we need will depend on the other constraints in the problem. Because if you had an even number, you'd have a plus one, minus one, and get zero and violate that constraint. Yeah. So these two constraints together make you have to have an odd number of impulses. And so, what do you guys think would be the benefit or the pros and cons between using negative impulses? Any thoughts? Ideas? So we can account for vibration. So we're still enforcing that vibration equation. So that's still part of the solution process that, hey, we're going to still limit vibration below VTOL. We're just going to change what that impulse sequence needs to be. Let it be have negative values. Yeah. Yeah, that's going to make it.
We're going to use more power, but.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's kind of both the pro and con of that. Of one set of pros and cons for this method is that, yeah, we're going to be able to, we're going to shorten this duration, the shaper duration, if we allow negative impulses, right? Which means we can get places faster. Like this increase in duration is going to be limited, be smaller than just positive shapers.
How does it shorten duration?
Shortens the duration. If we look at. So, original impulse, right? So, if I have to have a positive impulse, right, it can only go there, right? Or over here or over there, right? But if I allow myself to have a negative impulse, and I'm actually adding two more impulses, it's a little bit harder to visualize. But what I can do is, right, I need a sum of these three together to be zero. Right, so I'm not sure I got the. It should be pretty close. So I can draw each one of those, and if you add the sum of the three of those together, you end up with zero after the third one. And you can move faster, at least partially, because you're giving yourself more freedom to find the right time optimal place. You have additional parameter in your solution now. That third time that you didn't have before. So that's one big benefit. We can move faster. And it kind of makes sense. From this kind of command, we're kind of pushing on our system harder. So we're going to use more energy. But we should get there faster. Okay. What else might happen here? Any ideas?
Good things or bad things?
Either way. That's exactly right. So in this case, these unity magnitude shapers, since I've gotten rid of that positive amplitude constraint, right, I can get n% vibration more than the unshaped case with these negative shapers. So if I have three impulses, what I'm saying is I can get 300% of the vibration I had without input shaping if I'm using a unity magnitude shaper. How's that happen? It's not reading it properly. Yeah, my timing is going to be off.
Your normalized frequency is not 1.
Well, yeah, I'm going to have error. So let's draw. I think an easy way to look at it is this plot I have up here right now already. Let's erase it. So I have some response. And let's just give a 1. Let's do these colors. So I have A1, okay? And I know my next impulse, if I have a positive one first, my next impulse has to be a negative. You know, we actually can say that A1 is 1. Okay. So then using this union of magnitude, what's the sign of my next impulse? Negative 1, right? And if I want to maximize vibration, where do I put negative 1? It's negative 1 impulse. I want to maximize vibration. But exactly here, right? Right, so we'll have a minus 1 there. So then I get some response from that one. Okay, if I'm trying to maximize vibration, I have a next impulse is 1. Where does it go? So for all time after this, what do I get? 300% vibration. So you're going to have to work to get your frequency this wrong, right? But what can happen is that there's some mode of vibration out there that didn't matter before, but now you've amplified it by 3, and it might matter. Right? So it's something to be aware of when using these input shapers, right? There's other ways we can kind of mitigate this effect, right? But if you're using a negative input shaper, be aware that you can excite high mode oscillation if you're wrong.
So you probably need to know your system better.
A little bit, yeah. You need to know, at least know what, you know, we have some dominant, like a crane we've taught before, we basically just model it as a pendulum, right? If I'm going to use and a negative shaper on a crane, is going to cause no trouble at all, right? Because that pendulum mode's so much lower than any other vibratory mode of a crane. So you're going to be way out. It's going to be fine. But if you use like a robotic arm, like this stuff been used on disk drives, right? I remember that story from 201, lawsuits and such. You get those kind of systems, yeah, you're going to have multiple modes. So you at least need to know experimentally, if nothing else, where your natural frequencies are at. And we'll get to one way a little bit later today how to get estimates of natural frequencies experimentally without really going through the kind of first principles modeling. There's another benefit to these unity magnitude shapers that comes up a lot in space systems, actually. So this has been on shuttles and things like that, satellite missions. So if I have an original command here that's either off, meaning 0, or on, 1, and I input shape that with a unity magnitude input shaper, my resulting shape command is always either off or on. I don't need any intermediate states. Right. This case, right, I had a command that was either off or on, and I convolved with a ZV shaper. I needed some intermediate states to be able to make that happen. Right. If I have done this with a unity magnitude shaper, it looks like this, right? So now it's still either off or on. Why would that be important, let's say, for satellites, since that's the one I mentioned? Yeah, so that's kind of one big problem with satellites. That kind of, you don't have a lot of external friction going on. So if things start vibrating, things start going out of control, it's hard to stop. That's true. Other ideas. That's one big one.
Maybe.
What kind of, we have a satellite expert in the room. What is our main kind of satellite attitude control mechanisms?
Actuators.
What kind of actuators?
Electromagnetic or spinning mass.
Okay, so you have these masses that spin up, right, that basically use conservation of angular momentum to move the thing around. Bigger satellites, you have thrusters on occasion, right? So do you have intermediate states on jet rocket thrust? Not generally, right? So thrusters, there's some you can, but they tend to work a lot better if you're just on or off, right? And you'll see these like the shuttle positioning, the space station, kind of little spurts of gas coming out, right? They're either on or off. So I can guarantee I have either on or off commands and still low vibration by using unity magnitude shapers, right? That jet stream to position the satellite doesn't have this 0.5 for those thrusters, generally speaking. Can, if you want to stop quicker, that's right. So you want to move quicker, you want to stop quicker. You have systems that have a limited number of states, right? So satellites are one with kind of thruster type control. We put this on a crane at Boeing that was built in 1946 or something like that. So it didn't even have variable speed drives. All it did to drive the motors on the crane was close a mechanical switch via a relay. So we didn't have half speed for that crane, right? So we used a magnitude shaper, and that switch opened and closed at the right times according to the shaper, and we're still able to move it without any vibration.
Would it be useful for manufacturing process if we just to stop so it can be worked on and move again, back and forth?
Perhaps, but this stop here in the middle of this command, you don't really get to. That's dictated by the natural frequency. Yes. So the stop you see here is not necessarily going to be long enough to get any real work done. Right? So the stop there is not, it's part of the command. And this timing needs to be exact or we're not going to get zero vibration anymore. Yeah. So you need magnitude shapers. There's somewhere in between. It was actually a big piece of my PhD work, was working on these guys, coming up with this. You specify negative amplitude shapers. So instead of forcing everything to plus or minus one, allow just a little bit of a negative impulse. And then kind of what are the, you know, research was what are the effects of that.
So this wouldn't work for on-off systems.
This doesn't work for on-off systems. So what we're trying to get to is somewhere on the spectrum of the compromise between speed and energy use, or speed and high mode excitation, by allowing just a little bit of negative impulse, perhaps. Yeah, we can do that for any of these. So for an input shape command, say I had what you're saying, if I had kind of an XD desired position, and I said, hey, go to this position, and then kind of halfway through whatever I'm trying to do, oh, no, I want to go up here instead. We still can take this and go through the same process and get a shape command, and it'd be fine, no matter what the shaper is. So that change of direction is fine. These commands, as you might expect, you can kind of do this convolution. Might be good practice for your final exam to go through this. You get the kind of these little wiggles sometimes. And what's nice, I'm going to skip these since you already saw it. Come back to that in a second. Is that there's not a linear trade-off between duration, how quickly I'm able to move, and how negative that impulse is. So there isn't actually there's kind of this time, this nice curve where you allow any negative impulse. So the higher your negative impulse amplitude you have, the shorter durations are on this side of this plot. Right? So you see I go from a positive shaper, this orange curve, to allowing just a little bit of a negative impulse. I get a much bigger time savings than I go from the same change between those two.
But you're using more power.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, you got to go. You're going faster, so it's got to come from somewhere. Yeah. But the kind of the point is that I allow any negative impulse at all, I get a pretty big savings in duration relative to the downsides. So if you have a system that can do this SNA shaping, there's some benefit to doing that. Okay. So we saw these two shapers. ZV and ZVD. What constraint does the ZVD add to those that we just talked about? Yeah, so we limit the derivative of that vibration equation to zero as well. And that forces the slope of that sensitivity curve. Okay. Let's talk about, so far we've talked about kind of the pure, so we started out actually day one. There's input shaping looking at from a kind of pole zero cancellation perspective, which admittedly is not the most intuitive way to think about these, but I thought it was a nice connection to what we were doing at the time. And we've done the kind of pure time domain solution of this. Look at those constraints in the pure time domain, set up the optimization, and solve it. And we can solve the ZV enclosed form. We did that one. And the ZVD is known in closed form. But there's also other ways to get at the solution to these shapers. And one nice tool to do that is called a vector diagram. Okay. So what I can do in a vector diagram is take an impulse sequence. In this case, I have time t1 is 0, amplitude a1, amplitude a2, time t2. And what I want to do is plot this on the phase plane. That's what we call it. So basically, the angle of the vector from 0 is whatever frequency you're looking at times the time of the impulse. Okay, so in this case, and then the magnitude of the vector is just the magnitude of the impulse. So in this case, we have a1 at time t1. t1 is 0, so the angle for a1 is 0. We just draw a1 on the real axis of this plot. Okay. Then we have a vector a2, or impulse a2, so our vector length will be a2. It's at time t2, so I rotate it around omega t2. So I have two impulses. I've taken the impulse sequence and plotted them on this called a phase plane. Okay. And why we would want to do that is, what's kind of cool about this is, the resultant of those two vectors is proportional to how much vibration that impulse sequence creates. Right? So if I want to know how much this impulse vibration this impulse sequence creates, I just got to add these vectors together and I get this guy, and that's proportional to how much vibration we would get out of this input shaper. So moving vectors around to get zero is in a lot of ways easier than solving that full constraint set of equations that we came up with before, right? So we can analyze. So in this case, we're saying, hey, this A1, A2, it's not going to work so well at this frequency we drew this diagram for, right? What can we do to get to a shaper that would work well? Add a little bit of time. So, okay, yeah, we can say, well, that's the wrong time for A2. We really want A2 to be here.
Right.
So that A1 and A2 exactly cancel, and we get 0. That's one solution. And that actually would be the ZV shaper. What we also can do, what if I did something like that? So I have this two impulse sequence, so I can just add a third impulse. So now A1 plus A2 plus A3 is still 0.
That's a negative impulse you're talking about.
It's just later. Well, this one's positive, it's just later in time. So it's rotating. These rotate around the plane. Right, so it's just opposite of phase of the resultant of the first two impulses. Right, so remember, this angle, so this is omega T3, the angle from here to A3. Yep, so these guys, right? So they cancel in the y direction, right? And then this plus that add together to cancel the A1. So now I have, I had those first two impulses that create some vibration. I can add a third and get 0.
Wouldn't it just be simpler or, I guess, faster to have your A2 180 degrees from A1?
Yeah, I'm not saying this is a time optimal solution. I'm saying it's a solution. Right? Remember, there are infinitely many of these. Right? I could take A3, and if I could pick 15 little vectors around here, and as long as they added to cancel AR, it still works.
These are all positive?
These are all positive so far.
And so would a negative one just be 180?
Yes. So we can allow negative impulses, we just learned. So one faster way to do that, what we just saw, instead of waiting until it rotates around, well, I'll just have a negative one at an earlier time. Right?
Okay, that makes
sense. So now this has this is omega T3, and T3 is a negative vector. So this is a really nice design tool. So you can analyze shapers. This is actually how the EI shaper came about to begin with. They came up with this vector diagram tool at first. And we're playing with these vectors and got to a nice solution, and then backed out what's the real formulation for the EI shaper based on the impulses they got here. It's kind of cool. So my advisor did that, came up with this as an undergrad, apparently. Claims to have done it in his sleep. I don't know that I believe him. came to him in a dream. So we looked at robustness. Here's some kind of plots. These are should look familiar to ones that were in the notes. A little bit neater than the ones I drew on board. So here's our ZB shaper. What does this number represent? Close. Insensitivity. Yeah. So we call it in the shaper world. So what does that 0.06 mean in this case for the robustness of this?
Yeah. Your model can be
right.
1.03 or point.
Yeah, so I have kind of plus or minus 3% around my design frequency, and I still get 95% reduction in vibration. It's pretty good. Okay. And then we saw the ZBD, right? So quite a bit wider, but twice as long. So we go from half a period to one period. Okay. What do you think the unity magnitude versions of these curves look like? Near the design frequency, you don't see a lot of difference. Right, there's a little bit of difference. So here I've put up the unity magnitude shaper. It's actually only a third of a period long. But near the design frequency, I give up a little bit. So it's hard to see here, but it is a little bit narrower, but not much. Right, you do give up. I mean, you can't have this problem out at higher frequencies. So way over here at 3, the unity magnitude is at 300%. But if you're around the design frequency, you don't see that. And then we have UMZBD. So the naming here, I've enforced all the ZV shaper constraints, but allowed unity magnitudes. I've enforced all the ZVD shaper constraints, but allowed unity magnitude impulses rather than just pop. And then we talked about the SI as well. We also can do this. We've talked primarily about changes in natural frequency. Damping varies as well. And we haven't talked about damping because damping affects the robustness, the vibration properties of the shaper much less than natural frequency does. And then quite often our approaches to generate robustness in natural frequency naturally end up in contributing to robustness and damping ratio as well. So the kind of lesson from this plot, if there is one, is that damping matters a lot less. Right? The frequency variations will show up a lot more and affect us a lot more. So let's take a look at these for a second. These, all the dots are shapers that are known in closed form or known in kind of semi-closed form in the terms that there's a curve fit that gives you the impulse amplitudes from the numerical solutions. So you see our ZV, we know here, EI, and then there's kind of extensions of the EI that have more humps. On the horizontal axis here is the duration of the shaper. Right, so how long is the shaper in terms of number of periods of oscillation? And then on the vertical axis is the insensitivity. So the width of that sensitivity curve at VTOL of 5% in this case. So what we see is that this is not just a strictly linear curve. There is some game to play here about picking where you're at on this curve. Right, so the blue line, SI shaper, we can design for any insensitivity I want. So I did that and plotted this guy. And basically what we're saying is that this blue line is the time optimum, is the fastest you can do input shaping for the given vibration constraints that we have. So we see down here, if I need this much robustness and sensitivity, the ZV shaper is a good choice. If I get out here, what I notice, if I allow my shaper to be a little bit longer, I get a big jump in robustness. So I wouldn't want to design a shaper here, really. It's not a good choice there. I can go just be a little bit longer and get dramatically better robustness. Right? And the same thing happens to a lesser extent out of these higher modes or higher durations, higher insensitivities. Okay. And notice, you know, as we saw, there's a big jump here. These guys are the same duration, but this is much more robust. So you want to be at those little kinks in this curve. We also have the same thing for we have, just like we had the SI, we can have a unity magnitude version of that SI shaper where we sample the frequencies within the range. And it gets faster, and we saw this one already. With a higher negative impulse amplitude I allow, the faster my shaper gets pulled left. I still can design for any insensitivity I want for either one of these, right, for the entire range there. Excuse me. So, our general design procedure for these input shapers, right? We're going to start by determining the nominal system parameters. And what I mean by that is figure out your damping ratio or your natural frequency and damping ratios. And quite often, only one or two really matter. Right? We need to determine how much they vary. So basically, how much insensitivity do we need to design into the shaper? Right? So for a crane, how much variation is there in cable length and during normal operations? For a robotic arm, how much does the frequency change as I move around the workspace and reach out and pull in close? As a robotic arm, how much mass am I picking up when I'm trying to move stuff? Right, that's going to change my natural frequency. I need to have some bounds on what those ranges of parameters are. Okay, so how much robustness is needed? Then it's up to you to pick the shaper or shapers, in some cases, to use. Okay. So if you're varying a lot, you might need to pick a shaper for some part of your workspace or some part of your operation, and a different shaper for some other. Or you can design an SI shaper based on the robustness, perhaps. So that's the where kind of knowing the available shapers and solutions comes in. And then for most of that, you know, this is at least the ones we've talked about already, we can give you an answer. You give me a natural frequency damping ratio and desired insensitivity, I can give you an answer. What the impulses should be. Okay. Okay. Questions so far? Let's talk about this case. Most of you probably have seen this video too. So in this case, this student is the same crane you saw earlier. It was using a kind of traditional crane butt pendant. In this case, there's only about 3 meters of cable up to the crane trolley. And then we have this kind of rigging hanging down below. And that will create, again, this kind of pendulum vibration, motor vibration, plus some string vibration. So you can see now, in this case, you get this mode where the hook and the payload are swinging in opposite directions. So each time that faded through black, there was 1 minute cut out of the video. And the guy's working really hard because I think it was a $200 prize on the line for the fastest time. So we get that. We have that kind of vibration. How do we get rid of that? We have this multi-mode. We have more than one mode of oscillation. How do we use input shaping for that? Two shapers. How do I do use two shapers? One for each mode, okay.
Different natural frequencies.
Sure, that's exactly right. So one way to get to a two mode, or an N mode extension of this, right, is to take a shaper, design an input shaper for each mode. Right? So in that case, we had some kind of low frequency that was the pendulum oscillation, right? And we had some higher frequency that was that string motion, string type oscillation. Okay. So we just take each one of those shapers, each one of those modes, and design the shaper for it. And then all we have to do is actually just convolve those two shapers together. And now we're going to get a shaper, a resulting impulse sequence here that would get rid of both modes of oscillation, both natural frequencies. Okay. This convolution process is just like we've been doing before. All right? I take the first impulse by this guy, I do it at time 0. Right? The first impulse by that guy, do it at time delta 2. Take this impulse times that guy, do it at time delta 1. This impulse on that guy, delta 1 plus 2. Right, so that convolution is still just multiplications and additions with delays as appropriate. Right. I see folks shaking heads. That makes sense? Okay. It did? Okay. And the reason this works is that convolution, right? Just like we talked before, this convolution process takes all the kind of frequency properties of this impulse sequence and passes them on to the resulting command. Right? Well, that does the same thing here. Right? We're going to take these two different shapers. We can effectively think about it as multiplying the frequency content of those shapers together. Right? So say we have a ZV shaper designed for 1 hertz. And here we're showing a much larger range than the sensitivity curves than we have before. So this plot, we've only been showing kind of this little part of it. But if you plotted the frequency all the way out to much higher frequencies than design, you get a plot that looks like that. Okay. So I've designed one ZB shaper at 1 hertz. So it's designed for this point right here. Okay. And I'm going to design a shaper, say, for 2 hertz. Is that second one. So this guy is designed for 2 hertz. Okay. And if I take those two shapers and convolve them together, I get a resulting sensitivity curve that looks like this one. So now I have the properties of the first one. Hey, it's 0 at 1, 3, 5, and 7. I have 0 at 1, 3, 5, and 7. The second shaper had 0 vibration at 2 and 6. I have 0 vibration at 2 and 6. So all this convolution process does in this frequency domain kind of plot is take this guy at every point and multiply it by that guy. And that's how you get to the resulting sensitivity curve. So you see, if I've designed those two properties, I get 0 at 1 and 0 at 2. So my combined convolved input shaper works.
Okay. You have 100% at time 0. Both.
This is not 0. This is frequency. So this is essentially the sensitivity curve. Just don't have a normalized frequency now. If all the shapers are positive, you can be limited to 100. Because it's actually, if you're doing this multiplication, you're actually doing it as the proportion. So it's 1 times 1 is 1. And then you multiply by 100 for the result to get to a percentage. Okay. So we also can do this. So we talked about kind of this SI idea for one mode. You also can, instead of picking those points over a continuous range, you can pick multiple ranges to limit vibration in. So in this case, we take that SI, the specified insensitivity idea, where we're solving the vibration at each one of these points, limiting vibration at each one of those points, and now I can split those out. And I could do that for n different modes if I wanted to as well. And enforce that vibration constraint at each one of those dots on this plot. So now I can get an input shaper that, you know, this one's designed for 1 hertz and then 2.75, I think it was. So now I have a shaper that has low vibration at both of those frequencies. Okay. This will give you a faster solution than the convolution process. Right? Because this is an optimization problem. You're solving for the time optimal case. Right. The first case, you solve each one independently, so you don't get any benefits from the kind of interaction between the two shapers if you do the convolved case. Excuse me. So here's that same move for earlier. We'll show the end of the unshaped case. And again, that took like 3 minutes and 50 seconds or something. And then here is this using a two-mode SI shaper. Same crane, 30 seconds later, same guy. And he does it in 11 seconds. Just using that two-mode shaper. Quite a bit better. Okay.
What kind of shaper was that? Was that a two-mode SI?
Two-mode SI. Okay.